Lara Black with Human Scale Business, and today I'm talking with Bruce Zignago. He's president of Zigco, a product development company based in Bozeman, Montana. He's also adjunct faculty at the College of Engineering in Montana State University. Bruce, what is design for manufacturing?
Design for manufacturing, or manufacturability, is just that. You're taking a design, and usually when you think of design, you're thinking of the function required for that product or service or something. And what you're doing is extending it to also think about the manufacturing of it, the cost of it. Let me give you a little history and then also expand the definition. When we started, I think in like 1977, a guy named Boothroyd and Dewhurst, and in fact, I think they still have a company focusing on this area, they came up with some of the thoughts around design for assembly. And the thought there was that if you think in terms of how you would assemble, how a robot would assemble things, which is not nearly as dexterous, flexible as a human being, that by doing that, you would lower the cost of building the product. So that design for assembly expanded to design for manufacturing, not just the assembly, but also the cost of the product and things like that. And now we say DFX, which means many things: design for manufacturability, design for shipping, design for serviceability, design for reliability, and it's expanded beyond that. So if you think about it, it's a more of a system view of your product from the beginning to the end of the value chain and designing it throughout all of that to be as efficient as possible.
That makes sense, especially thinking of the entrepreneurs who create products and refine the product and have it finished before they think about what's an expedient and economical way to ship the good to where it needs to go. So DFX makes sense.
When you think about it, it's like, why didn't we always do this? But, you know, things evolve, and the designer oftentimes is really focused on the functionality. And what happens, especially if that designer or that innovator doesn't have some of the knowledge base. In fact, at Hewlett-Packard, I worked for many years, 25 years with Hewlett-Packard. We called some of the R&D, the research and development engineers, designing with things called unobtainium, which is you can't make what you just designed. The function is there, but you can't make it. And so by adding the DFM side has helped tremendously in how we design products.
Can you provide a couple of examples of small issues or important issues that were resolved better through design than through the manufacturing process?
I'll start with some very, very simple things. Like, okay, I'm going to design something that is a pin that's going to be pushed into a hole as part of my assembly. Well, if I add some cost to that pin and actually put a chamfer on it, now when I go to assemble that pin to the hole, it fits easily and slides right in. And it's very simple, but if you're just thinking of designing the part, you wouldn't have put that chamfer into it.
I have to stop you. What's a chamfer?
If you look at the edge of a pin, a cylinder, if you will, if I take a little 45 degree angle at the very edge of it, so instead of it being a very sharp edge, now it's got this 45 degree angle at the front surface. Now you can see how that would fit into a hole because it's actually smaller than that hole, fits in there, self-centers, and then it's pushed in much easier than if you had that straight edge on the cylinder going into a pin.
So I can imagine that would reduce the time to line up the pin and get it in the right place.
Exactly. And assembly time is part of the cost of the manufacturing. Another one is, let's say as part of my product, it has some electronics and I need to plug the connector into another component during my assembly process. If I don't have that connector keyed in any way, and by keyed, think of looking at it and on one side of it, it has a ridge and on the other side, it doesn't. And there's a female and male that are keyed so that you can't put the connector in wrong. Think of your USB connector on your computer. You can't put it in upside down. It can only fit one way. Well, in the olden days, we didn't do that. And in the manufacturing process, we'd have to very specifically control, make sure that you look at the pins and you can only put it this way. And in fact, sometimes if you put them in backwards, the power pin would be going to signal pins and you could actually destroy the component in manufacturing. So the manufacturing people had to be very rigorous and disciplined how they manufactured by going to a keyed connector, something rather simple but very elegant. You now have only one way of assembling it and therefore avoid those problems. And you know, and there's many, many other things like that. And in fact, some of that is called pokayoke. It's a Japanese term coined by Shigeo Shingo from Toyota, and it means idiot-proofing or fool-proofing or mistake-proofing. I love it. It doesn't allow you to build the next part of the product unless it's built correctly. And let me give an example of something that has just rang true for me for many years is, and I don't want to pick on General Motors in particular, but the 1976 Chevy Monza. If you went there and you wanted to change the spark plugs, which is a common service thing to do to a car, correct? In order to change the spark plugs in a 76 Monza, you literally had to go in and loosen the motor mount bolts holding the engine onto the frame, pull it up so that you could get to one of the spark plugs. Obviously, that car didn't have design for serviceability thought through it when the designers designed that car. And so that's a great example of how far we've come. Now, in a big company, you take the manufacturing people, the people in customer satisfaction, and they're part of the design team from day one in the design phase, where as you're doing the innovation and ideation part of it, they're there trying to talk through, well, what about the service side? So what you're basically doing, if you step back and if you look at the very simple look at a design process, and if you think of design thinking, how people are talking about it today at like the Stanford School of Design, you have empathize, which is you try to understand the customer needs. You have define, where you're now taking those nebulous customer needs and defining them into product or concept requirements. You ideate or brainstorm on ways in order to get that, prototype it, and then test it back to, did that meet my original needs? And instead of doing that with a designer and then it gets thrown over the wall to manufacturing, you want to be thinking about the manufacturability, the reliability, the serviceability as you're in that defined stage in the early design thinking. So that's what you're really doing, is you're adding the system thinking earlier on in your process.
Having a cross-functional team makes sense in a big company, but what about people who are working as solopreneurs or small companies and they don't have all this expertise in-house? What is the right time in product development to focus on design for manufacturing or design for serviceability?
I think, again, it's right when they're first starting off. And I would assume, like, look at myself and our company, and we're very small. Affording a consultant to come in and talk you through those things could be cost, and probably is, cost prohibitive. And so I'd encourage that solopreneur or that entrepreneur that's just starting off to get on the web. Google is amazing. And if you search design for assembly, design for manufacturability, you'll find a tremendous amount of free material. In fact, preparing for this podcast, I just did a quick Google search before this, and there's some design for assembly and manufacturing PDF I found that is just wonderful with the essence of what I'm talking about in very clear form that is available free for folks to do that.
That's great. It certainly sounds that this category of thought, design for X, design for manufacturability, design for shipping, design for serviceability, all of those things would pay off to different people in the life cycle of the product. So certainly the design for manufacturing would reduce cost of the product through efficiency by reducing time in manufacturing. But also, there must be other ways that DFX pays off.
There's a number of tools in the engineer's toolbox or the product development toolbox. You know, there's things like FMEA, failure mode and effect analysis, where I'd encourage that solopreneur to really look through their design and go, how is this thing going to break? How is it going to fail? And how is it going to fail? What are the modes that which it does fail? And what is the effect of that failure? Is it catastrophic? Do I lose the sale? Do customers, God forbid, die? And you think through those things and you analyze what are the things I need to change to the design in order for that not to occur. So, for example, at Hewlett-Packard, where I spend a number of years, when it was with regards to electricity and things like that, where people could die, we had redundancies of design built in at least two levels, often three levels, that would have to occur in order for any problem to occur. And of course, there's safety agencies, but we usually had far greater requirements than what the safety agencies, just because of the design practices of Hewlett-Packard. And we do those things. So there's other things also that you look at with regards to the design. You do some tests. You think about, how is my customer going to use this product? And you try to test that early with prototypes. And you work it through and you break it. When it breaks, you find out, how did it break? And was this a use that the customer is going to use? Yes, it is. Do I need to accept that failure of it breaking? Or do I need to go back and design it, make it thicker, make it out of a different material, so that doesn't occur? And you're constantly balancing the cost of building the product through either the materials or the assembly or the shipping with the functionality, the intended use for the customer. Because you certainly don't want to over-design it and have the thing last 50 years, but the use case is only such that it would only be used one time, for example. That would be way over designing, and you're putting way too much cost into the product. And so there's many ways in which you can do that, and design for X, or as we've been saying, is just one of them. Another thing that I just thought about is the thing called late point differentiation. And so if that solopreneur or the entrepreneur has a product that needs to be modified for the different customers. So for example, they're building a product that has to work in America as well as Europe, and it's an electrical product. Well, Europe uses 220 volts power. We use 110 in the US. So you have to have the ability to have the product be able to handle both of those powers. We built a product that actually we'd have to put 110 volt power supply in it for the US, and we'd do a 220 volt supply for Europe. Well, our marketing people weren't always correct in our forecast, and so it would end up where sales were great in Germany, and maybe they were slower in the US than we had anticipated, and we had 100,000 extra units in America with 110 volt power supplies, and we needed to get them to Europe, but we had to tear them apart, take out the 110 volt supply, put in a 220 volt supply, which you can see cost us a lot of money and a lot of profits. So we went to switching power supplies that auto range, and that's what you see all the time now, is a power supply that can auto sense the voltage and it will take it from 110 to 240. Well, that's late point differentiated. Now the product can go either way. Well, with Europe, it expands even further. They have different power cords and they have different languages. And so what we would do is we would have the product be sent, and then we'd have a little slit in the box. And at the distribution center, if the product was going to Germany, they would put a German power cord and a German software into that little slit of the box. And now you've localized it, but you did it not until you were just shipping it. And so the whole idea of late point differentiating your product as late as possible so that you don't have as many SKUs, where you have to manage the inventory, where you have to manage the cost of all the things inferred from the larger inventory, but yet it gives your customer the options that they desire in the marketplace. And so all of these things, I think, are kind of stem from the whole concept of design for manufacturing, design for serviceability, and system design, if you will.
I love that category of thought of late point differentiation, because managing multiple SKUs is really a challenge for a small organization.
It can add a huge amount of cost in inventory. And as we all know, the largest reason for a small company to go out of business is lack of cash. And if a lot of your cash is tied up in inventory, then you're not being able to do the other things you need to do. And so being really smart in how you keep your inventory small, but don't miss that sale, that's a clever balancing act.
And you can't do it unless you think of it and design for it early on.